Let's begin today's lesson by immediately opening our Bibles to Genesis chapter 12. We're only going to read three verses, but I want you to follow along with me, please. Genesis chapter 12. We're going to read the first three verses. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it's page 11. So get to that spot. Now, Adonai said to Avram, "Get yourself out of your country, away from your kinsmen, away from your father's house. Go to the land I will show you. I will make of you a great nation. I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you are to be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, but I will curse anyone who curses you. And by you, all the families of the earth will be blessed." God, Adonai, which means Lord or Master, makes a covenant with Abraham, still called Avram at this moment. And this covenant occurs while Abraham was residing in Haran, up in Mesopotamia. Basically, what occurs is that God tells Abraham to leave Haran, to go where God will guide him. And God says, by the way, your father, Terah, and your father's other relatives, they're not welcome to come along. Now, I suspect what we see here is that since Terah, apparently went part way, then decided against going any further, God used somebody who would go that whole nine yards, Abraham. A large lesson is taught here. It is a biggie. Partial obedience isn't a little obedience. Partial obedience is disobedience. So we see God again dividing and electing and separating. This time, he's dividing and electing and separating the faithful members of Abraham's family away from the not so faithful. This principle is reflected over and over throughout the Bible, and none more dramatic than Christ's own words in Luke 14, verses 25 and 26. Large crowds were traveling along with Yeshua, and turning, he said to them, "If anyone comes to me and does not hate his father, his mother, his wife, his children, his brothers and his sisters, and yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple." Well, what I want to do now is take a little bit of time with this covenant with Abraham to explain both what a covenant is about and to explain the general nature of covenants in biblical times. God gives Abraham an instruction. He follows it up with a promise that consists of several parts. Now, of course, the instruction is that Abraham should leave the area he's in, which is Haran, go to a place that God will show him, and to separate himself from his father and from his brother. God then issues a set of promises, and those promises are the following. First, God will make Abraham and his descendants into a great nation. This means that Abraham and his descendants are going to become a people. By definition, a separate people that will grow to the size of a nation, one that up to that point didn't exist. But if that's going to happen, then Abraham and his wife Sarai must have children, and their children must have children, and lots of descendants after them, to the point that sometime in the future there will be a sufficiently large number of these descendants who've remained identified with one another as having a common family heritage, that they can be counted as a nation. Second, God will bless Abraham, and Abraham himself will become a blessing. In other words, God is going to give Abraham his special favor. Abraham is going to be treated special by God, and some wonderful things are going to happen to him that he doesn't deserve. But God's chosen to do it that way. What God does for Abraham is going to benefit more than just Abraham. What Abraham does in obedience to God is going to itself going to do is itself going to be a blessing to others. Third, God will bless those who bless Abraham, and God will curse those who curse Abraham. Boy, I wish I had a flashing red light and a siren to announce this verse. This is not some set of idle words. This isn't God being condescending to Abraham. It's not patting him on his little head like he would a child, all right, trying to make him feel good. This is a serious warning, but it's not to Abraham. Rather, it's to all the peoples of the world from that moment forward. God expects all humanity to recognize that Abraham is chosen of God. He is to be respected and honored. On the flip side, God says he's going to take it personally if anyone should decide to be an enemy of Abraham. That is, God's going to take sides. God is going to take sides against those that line up against Abraham. I want to take that a step further. Remember that in Bible language, God is not just referring to Abraham as an individual. He is speaking of Abraham's line. Even more specifically, of the special nation that will come from Abraham, certainly his descendants. Now, who are those descendants that's going to form this special nation? We're going to soon see that this nation that shall be the product of this covenant is Israel. Abraham would eventually have many children, out of which only one, however, represented that continuing line that would eventually lead to Israel. So not all of Abraham's descendants have this special covenant blessing and warning attached to them. I pointed out earlier that God has already laid out a pattern for this principle. He divides, he elects, he separates. Abraham came from the line of Peleg, who was divided and elected away from the line of Shem, who was divided and elected away from the line of Noah, who was divided and elected away from the line of Seth, who was divided and elected from the line of Adam. In time, as Abraham produces sons, we will see that one particular son will be divided, elected, and separated away from all of his brothers. The result of this God pattern of dividing, separating, and electing is what we often hear called the line of promise. Typically, this line of promise is considered to start with Abraham, but the Bible shows us that in reality, it goes all the way back to Seth. Fourth, God will make the name of Abraham great. Abraham, you see, is going to be greatly rewarded, and his name is going to be lifted high among men, among humanity. Remember, where it says name, we really ought to think of the word reputation in our modern Western culture. God will make the reputation of Abraham great. What is fascinating is that even in our time, 4,000 years later, more than half the population of this planet is represented by the three great monotheistic religions of Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, and in all of them, Abraham is the revered patriarch, all of them. Five, God will use Abraham to bless all the families of the earth. What God is going to do through Abraham is not going to be a blessing only to Abraham, not just to his descendants, not even to that special nation that's going to come from this blessing, Israel. This blessing brought about through Abraham's selection and election is going to benefit all mankind. Let's take a look now at what a biblical covenant is and is not. Of all the biblical institutions, a covenant is the one we need to understand best because it is through the institution of a covenant that God's set-apart people, Israel, were created, and through a covenant that by trust in God, namely in Messiah Yeshua, we can be saved from eternal destruction. Webster's Dictionary defines a covenant as a binding agreement and as an agreement among church members to defend that church's doctrines. It also describes a covenant as a formal contract. Without doubt, these definitions pretty well nail down the Western culture, 21st century idea of just what a covenant is and of what we as believers generally picture in our minds when the word covenant is used in the Bible. But Webster's misses the mark substantially when it comes to what a covenant in biblical terms and times meant, and it still means. That is, what God means by a covenant. First and foremost, the number one description of a covenant is, it is sacred. Sacred. It's holy. In Bible times, covenants between men were used to sell land, to make alliances, to make war and peace, even to make provisions for using a water well by somebody other than its owner. A covenant could be by mutual agreement, and with which both parties had obligations to fulfill. Or, just as often, it signaled an obligation upon only one party, and that obligation could even be imposed upon someone by a more powerful person or a nation, or by God himself. We tend to think of a covenant as a promise or a contract, then how its effect is dealt with within the framework of our judicial system. Therefore, we picture covenants as human agreements written by human hands, enforced by human means. We all know that time or people or circumstances can cause oral promises as well as written contracts to terminate, or to change, or to simply become obsolete. Penalties for breaking a contract are usually pretty small in our society, normally involving a monetary settlement. That happens every day. A court of law can invalidate, it can change a contract. Men and women break personal promises on a fairly consistent basis. Governments can form a constitution, their contract with the people, and amend it, throw it away, start all over again. People can mutually or unilaterally change their minds and simply dissolve or disavow a contract or a promise, like with a divorce, with relatively little penalty. None of this is possible within the biblical definition of a covenant. The Hebrew word for covenant is berit, which comes from the Hebrew word bara, which means to cut or to divide. And I'm going to show you the relevance of that meaning shortly. The Greek word used in the Bible for covenant is diatheke. Diatheke. And this Greek word misses the mark rather substantially as a translation of the Hebrew word berit. Now, I've taught you on a number of occasions that culture and language come as a package, and that within any given culture, they have a number of traditions and ideas and some basic societal concepts that are unique, for the most part, to their culture, pretty foreign to other cultures. And since that's the case, there are many unique Hebrew concepts, such as the concept embodied in the Hebrew word berith, or shalom, or mashiach, Messiah, that don't always have parallels in another language or culture. I want you to think about that for a moment, because unless you're a language expert, it isn't readily apparent to most of us that there are words in one language that don't directly correspond to a word in another language. That is, we can't just make a list of Hebrew words and then make a parallel list alongside that of that represents their English equivalents. As a matter of fact, it takes approximately one-third more English words than Hebrew words to say the same thing. A Hebrew Bible is only about, that is written in Hebrew, is only about two-thirds of the number of pages of an English Bible. That ought to be a clue about translation difficulty right there. I want to illustrate this for you. Yom, very simple Hebrew word, means day in English. It is the same concept in both English and Hebrew. They have it in common. It's pretty straightforward. It's the concept of a 24-hour period of time, one rotation of the earth. And they each have a word to precisely define that concept. Yom in Hebrew means day in English. So we got a good match. But the word shalom in Hebrew embodies an overall concept that simply doesn't exist either in Greek or in English-speaking cultures. And since the concept of shalom doesn't exist in Greek or English cultures, naturally, there's no Greek or English word equivalent for it. So the Bible translator tries for something near to it. Or he'll use a series of words to try to get the concept across to the reader. With our example of shalom, for existence, we often see the words peace or grace used in English to translate that single word shalom. But peace and grace just scratch the surface of what that single word shalom means to the Hebrew mind, because it's a concept. It's the name of a concept. More troublesome, though, is what happens when a translator has insufficient understanding of the culture behind the language he's trying to translate. You don't need to be at all familiar with French culture to learn to speak French. You don't need to be familiar with Hebrew culture to learn to speak Hebrew. The problem is that without uniting the understanding of the culture that's tied together with its language, the translator will only understand what that word means in the context of his own cultural sense, not theirs. You see what I mean? And that's the main problem we have with Bible translations. Precious few translators have any depth of knowledge of ancient Hebrew culture and concepts. And worse, I'm afraid to say, often there are built-in prejudices against Hebrew culture. So the translation goes forward with a negative view or an outright incorrect understanding. Now, many of us who've purchased small appliances or electronic widgets made in China, which is probably two-thirds of them, often find the accompanying instruction manuals to sound a little bit odd. Sometimes they can be downright funny. I vividly recall buying a riding toy for one of my grandchildren. And I was told in the assembly manual I was to tighten a certain screw or a nut until it was happy. Now, how do I know when that screw is happy? Of course, in the Chinese way of thinking, a correctly tightened screw is a happy screw. And in a dictionary, you'll find that the words happy and correct, you know what? They have very similar meanings. But for Americans, at least, happy is an emotion. It's an emotion that's displayed by living beings. It's not a technical term. It's not a mechanical term. So the word happy seems appropriate enough to a Chinese translator, but the concept is all fouled up when you cross over cultural boundaries. Do you see my point? We have that same problem in so many places in the Bible. So let's get back to our adjusting our understanding of what a biblical covenant actually is within Hebrew culture, the culture of the Bible, as opposed to what we generally assumed it must be in modern Western culture. Now, partially because of the use of the Greek word diatheke in the New Testament, and also partially because of the Hebrew concept of berit, covenant, because they don't have a direct parallel to either Greek or English-speaking cultures, Christians have adopted the belief that what is being referred to as an equivalent to our concept of a will, like in the sense of a last will and testament. In fact, I've heard many sermons over my years that seeks to explain a covenant as exactly those terms, a will or a testament, and then draw a word picture of the reading of a will at somebody's death. Therefore, since our culture, in our culture, the legal terms will and testament are almost synonymous, we have come to use the English word testament, as in Old Testament and New Testament, to describe the two halves of the Bible. And boy, is that concept off the mark. No modern, credible Bible scholar should defend using the Greek word diatheke, or its English equivalent, testament, especially not the word will, as a proper translation or proper concept of the Hebrew berit, covenant. So why do we continue to say Old Testament, New Testament, or Old Covenant, New Covenant, instead of Old Covenant, New Covenant? Habit, tradition, ignorance of what a biblical covenant amounts to. Now, one of the major differences between the typical Christian understanding of a covenant and what God means by that word is that a biblical covenant is a permanent thing unless it's conditional. Now, see, we see both conditional and permanent covenants in the Bible. A permanent covenant cannot be retracted. A conditional covenant can be. Another difference is that the penalty for breaking a biblical covenant was usually severe. Often it was death. But the overwhelming characteristic of a God-made biblical covenant, as opposed to a covenant between men, or even modern-day promises and contracts, is that once God makes a covenant, it literally becomes a physical law of the universe, like gravity or the speed of light or the laws of thermodynamics. In fact, the Hebrews themselves acknowledge this because berit, their word for covenant, is also used to indicate the laws of nature. When God makes a covenant with his creation, that covenant is now woven into the very fabric of both space and time. It affects how the universe operates. It also has an effect in the spiritual realm because the spiritual realm is the source of that God-made covenant. Why is that? Because it happens first in the spiritual sphere before it becomes present in the physical sphere of existence. I want to give you a detailed example of this covenant God principle. When God first made the universe and then man, we're told there was no death. The laws of the universe, we might call them the laws of nature, were such that everything that was created was apparently built originally to exist forever. Somewhere along the line, something changed. Our time together is such I can't address the matter as completely as I'd like to, and no matter what my thoughts are about it, they do contain a lot of speculation because the Bible doesn't directly answer all of our questions about creation and death and decay. Nonetheless, we are told that death entered the world when Adam and Eve fell from grace. Did that mean universal death? The death of everything. The death of stars and planets and moons, the sun and the earth? I don't think so. The Bible uses the term death as meaning the end of life. If there's no life, there can be no death because living things die. Stars and moons and planets exist, but they're not life. The death that the Bible is talking about as regards the fall of man is the death of living creatures. So if the fall of man didn't start the universe decaying, what did? In my estimation, the thing that started the universe itself decaying is the very thing that Adam's fall was patterned after. The fall of Lucifer, who came to be called Satan, the adversary, the devil. I want to delve into the pattern of concepts. This is going to be brief. And over time, I'm going to add to it. But the common question we usually ask of any biblical event or law or instruction or principle or decision is, why? Why, oh, why, oh, why? Why is almost always the wrong question to ask about God-ordained things. Why, I think, can reasonably be considered as the Greek way of thinking. You generally won't find answers to why in the Bible. The way we have been taught to seek and discover why, by using the scientific method, which again is a Greek way of thinking. Rather, God instructs us by showing us patterns that he's established. He describes and explains an event later. A similar event will occur with a similar method and a similar outcome. The reason that the later event occurred the way it did was that it conformed to the pattern of the previous event. God's way of explanation is by means of exposing patterns, not explaining why. So, with the principle of God patterns in mind, we know that Satan's fall occurred sometime before Adam's fall, obviously, because Satan was already exiled to planet Earth by the time Adam arrived. Satan's crime against God, pride and rebellion, occurred in the spiritual realm, right? Not in the physical realm. But all biblical indications are that until Lucifer sinned against God, there was no evil in the spiritual realm. Yet, like so many spiritual matters, this one had its effects on the physical world as well. Satan's fall initiated a change in the way the universe operated. After the fall, everything that existed would now start to deteriorate. No exceptions. Adam and Eve were supernaturally brought forth onto a planet in a universe that was already decaying due to Satan's introduction of sin. He brought that with him when he was kicked out of heaven and sent to planet Earth, where he lived in exile along with his band of fallen angels. Then sometime later, when Adam and Eve were created, Satan essentially infected them with sin, which now brought death to living creatures. Suddenly, the whole universe, everything except the spirit realm, was decaying. It is my contention that the dimension of time began at the point of Satan's rebellion. As I told you in lesson 6, time is essentially the measurement of decay. If there's no decay, there's no time. We often hear scientists speak of how our universe is aging, and what they mean is that everything right down to the atomic level is deteriorating. It's winding down. Everything in the universe is aging. On Earth, wind and rain erode mountain chains and seashores. The sun has a finite amount of fuel. It's going to eventually run out. Every physical thing is slowly but surely dissolving back towards its basic elemental makeup. Spiritually, things also changed. Evil was unleashed. It had to be dealt with because evil pollutes perfection. Sin defiles God's holiness. A Savior had to be prepared to save man from complete annihilation. The abyss had to be readied to imprison the leader of evil, Satan, at the appropriate time. Angels would eventually become warriors because sin had entered the world. Now death entered the world. First, the fall of Satan initiated the decay of inanimate objects. Then the fall of man initiated the decay of living creatures. Prior to that, there would have been no need for a line of promise, for an immaculate conception, nor for a horrendous crucifixion. We today would not be preparing for a rapture while warning the unbelieving of Armageddon if not for the evil that began the death spiral of all things existing in our universe, living and inanimate. And it just drives me nuts. There's a serious intellectual conversation today, even in churches, about whether there even is such a thing as evil. It's amazing. Now, here's another example that is an illustration of the effects of a biblical covenant. It's an illustration. We all understand the effects of gravity, even if we don't understand how it works. Matter of fact, scientists don't understand how it works. What would happen if someday God abolished gravity as a physical law of the universe? Fortunately, at least until the new heaven and earth are created, gravity is a permanent law of nature. It has no conditions or time limit that we're aware of. Well, gravity is the physical phenomenon that causes the moon to revolve around the earth to orbit around the sun. Our seasons, our weather, our temperatures stay within an ideal range that affords life to survive. Photosynthesis, that's the basis of plant life, depends on our connection and our relationship with the sun. Without gravity, that connection would be broken. We stay stuck to the ground, to the earth, instead of floating up and away because of gravity. When we drop a glass, it falls to the ground, always. What if God decided simply one day to delete gravity? Well, a lot would change. A chain reaction of monumental proportions would begin, wouldn't it? The way the universe operates would be very different. What I'm getting at is that death and gravity behave like covenants. Universal laws upon which most other aspects of nature and heaven depend. Change one, many others are affected. God made every one of the universal laws of spiritual and physical nature, and they all work together. None were accidental. None operates independently. So when God allowed decay, then he allowed death to be added to the equation, for instance, it changed a physical law of nature. And this change had its spiritual counterpart. Everything about the universe was changed to adapt to this new reality, spiritually and physically. I hope you see this. When God makes a covenant, any covenant, it's not like you and I promising to make payments on our car. Nor is it even like human marriage vows, although I wish it was. The universe does not react to whether humans enter into a loan contract or even into a marriage vow, and it's not affected when those contracts and vows are broken. But some parts, if not all, of the vast body of spiritual and physical laws of the universe are affected when God makes a covenant. And please understand me, this is an allegory. I'm not making an analogy. I'm not speaking from emotion. I'm not, at least trying not to exaggerate. When God makes a covenant, the spiritual and physical universe is never the same again. Now, if God is to communicate with man, He's got to dumb it down a whole lot. It has to be in terms that man can understand. So it seems that God created a kind of covenant system, something visible, physical, tangible, a covenant protocol, if you would, by which humans could recognize and understand when God was creating a covenant, what its terms were, and as much as a human can understand, what its impact is. And mankind adopted a similar pattern for making various agreements among ourselves. Of course, in the Bible, we see covenants made by humans, and we see covenants made by God. And as we would expect, you know what? They look an awful lot alike in their formats. The oldest, most primitive way of creating a covenant was called cutting a covenant. Hebrew, berit, which literally means cutting or dividing. The earliest covenant thinking, then, happened by a representative of each side of the proposed covenant agreement cutting their arm with a knife, then holding the bleeding wounds together to signify the mixing of blood. In some cultures, blood was actually sucked from each other's wounds and ingested by the opposite party. Solemn oaths were then sworn, invoking the name of the god that each participant worshipped, because a covenant was sacred. In all cases, a blood and a god, these were the center of the ceremony. Now, in time, a different ritual appeared, which involved cutting animals instead of each other. And generally, this cutting meant not just slashing an animal to draw some blood, but literally killing it and cutting it up, dividing it into halves or into even maybe several pieces. And the pieces would get laid out on the ground, organized into two separate groups, and then both participants of the covenant would walk between the pieces while swearing an oath in the name of their God. Blood was integral in covenant making because covenants were deemed to be a life fellowship. Why is that? Because life is in the blood. Understand what that means. The covenant was lifelong. The participants considered themselves to have been joined together almost as one flesh under whatever terms that covenant demanded. Hundreds of years before Abraham was born, God told Adam that life was in the blood. Mankind had not forgotten, and it was pretty evident. In the countless murders that had occurred by now, with the slaughtering and eating of animals for food as a normal practice, it was pretty self-evident that blood was central to life. Since blood was involved, it was understood that a covenant was a very serious matter. It wasn't to be entered into lightly. The usual penalty for breaking a covenant was death. Covenants were so hallowed, they were established with pomp and ceremony. Salt, together with bread, was usually eaten as the final event of a covenant ceremony. The participants eating a meal together upon completion of the covenant was a way of signifying that a new family type of relationship had been created. Salt became so important to the transaction that the making of a covenant took on a nickname called a covenant of salt. In fact, in some cultures, the act of simply exchanging salt was at times enough to conclude a covenant over an everyday matter. We find this idea of the covenant of salt mentioned in both the Old and the New Testaments, by the way. Since salt was the final step of the covenant-making process, it kind of sealed the deal, so to speak. Salt was considered a symbolic of peace. And when the salt was partaken of, the covenanting process was completed. Similar to today when we apply our signatures to a legal document, it finalizes that agreement. Well, after the arrival of Moses and his receiving the Torah on Mount Sinai and the institution of the sacrificial system, God instructed the Levite priest to always add salt to the sacrifices. I mentioned earlier that when God made a covenant, it's forever. And the Israelites understood the awesome heaven and earth changing device that a covenant from God was. Since covenants were to be sealed with salt, the God-ordained practice of sprinkling salt on sacrifices was to remind Israel that the covenants between God and Israel were everlasting, and that the covenant process of sacrificing an innocent animal had the desired effect of making peace between God and Israel. Now, as we move along in our study of the Torah, we're going to come across some of the covenant ceremonies and procedures, and I'm going to point them out to you as we come across them. It's typically only small elements of these ceremonies are recorded for us. But I also want to mention that often in the New Testament, we see these references to salt. Now, I hope you see that those references to salt are all about crucial aspects of covenant making and sacrificial procedure. It's not about cooking. For example, in Mark 9:50, Jesus says, "Have salt in yourselves and be at peace with one another." Christ also says, "You are the salt of the earth." Paul says, "Let your speech be gracious, always seasoned with salt." Here, salt is being recalled as the final element of a covenant or a sacrifice. Therefore, it's symbolic of peace and of purity, of truth. In fact, by Yeshua's day, when someone used the term covenant of salt, it indicated a holy, enduring covenant. And the covenant of salt also came to mean the specific covenant made that God made with Abraham. So whenever we see the use of the word salt in the scriptures, New Testament or Old Testament, understand that in the mind of the Hebrew author, something of great holiness in relation to a covenant or a sacrifice is what's being referred to. So armed with that understanding now of covenants, let's go back to the terms of the covenant that God made with Abraham, understanding this is a permanent covenant. By definition, a covenant with God is forever. In the first three verses of chapter 12, we see God telling Abraham he would become a great nation, that God would be blessed, and Abraham himself would be a blessing. God would bless Abraham, and Abraham himself would be a blessing. That Abraham's name or reputation would be great, and that Abraham would therefore bless all the families of the earth. Perhaps the most important aspect of this covenant in our day and time, God would bless those who bless it, Abraham, and curse those who curse him. These promises aren't idle and they're not obsolete. These promises, given in the form of a covenant, became a law of the spiritual and physical universe. Folks, these are just an unchangeable fact of life. The instant God pronounced it, it just became a forever part of life for everybody. To ignore this is just folly. To fight against it leads to destruction because the entire operation of the universe has been finely tuned to an inexorably advance towards achieving the purpose of this permanent covenant. Now Israel, today that's primarily the Jews, are the descendants of that unbreakable covenant handed down from Abraham to Isaac, then Isaac to Jacob, who, remember, had his name changed by God to Israel, then to Jacob's sons, who are the 12 tribes of Israel. Now, although there were other sons of Abraham, many in fact, the Bible only addresses one in particular other than Isaac, and that was Ishmael. Another important division took place that we will investigate in the coming weeks, and it concerns the covenant line of promise. That is, the division that was all about electing which of Abraham's sons would inherit all those promises contained within the covenant that God made with Abraham, and we're going to find it specifically and explicitly went to Isaac. From Isaac, it went to his son Jacob, called Israel. So everything
that was originally given to Abraham was eventually inherited by the tribes of Israel. Now we can and should be fair-minded in the matters we see happening in the Middle East, particularly as concerns Israel and the proposed Palestinian state. But the bottom line is, our support must always be of Israel, who retains Abraham's covenant. One part of that covenant we ought to be greatly concerned with says, I'll bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you. And since Israel inherited God's covenant with Abraham, the you is Israel. That's just biblical fact. It's not political. It's not allegorical. Those who stand with Israel, the current holders of Abraham's covenant, will be blessed and favored by God. Those who oppose or seek to injure Israel will be regarded lightly by God and will be judged for their disobedience. Do you stand with Israel? I know most of you listening to me do. Do all of you? Do you pray for Israel? Do you understand that the former land of Canaan belongs to Israel? Not to the Palestinians, not to anyone else, including the church. Do you support Israel tangibly? Or do you prefer to be even-handed and support Israel's enemies as well? Take some of what God promised to Israel. Give it to the Palestinians for the sake of world peace. For the sake of the worldview of what is fair. A view that is the opposite of God's clearly stated and unbreakable mandate. Supporting Israel does not mean to agree with everything they do. They're humans. They have evil inclinations just like we all do. And currently, many are secular, not downright atheists. So often, they're not walking with God. And you know what that leads to? Bad decisions. Supporting Israel doesn't mean worshiping the state of Israel. Doesn't mean worshiping the Jewish people or declaring Jews above reproach. Rather, it means to come alongside of them, embrace them, help them, comfort them, love them, show them respect. Encourage them to do what's right in God's eyes. Remind them who they are. Pray that they return to Him. Show them that those promises of God entitle them to that land inheritance, and to retain their title as God's chosen people. We'll continue with Genesis next time.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning, products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.